This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Helen King
and Dan Wacker.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Helen, you're working for MPR, Manawatu People's Radio. How long have you been doing that?
As an employee for about a year and a half, and I'm their funding administrator, and I did it on a contractual basis for about a year and a half before that. So I work at the moment about 16 hours a week doing funding and various other projects as well.
Okay, so how does that work?
A lot of funding applications and a lot of work with donors. So the station gets most of its income from New Zealand On Air. We're a government-run entity, but we have to raise around another 20% through external sources. Okay. So my job is to find and coordinate that money.
Okay. So it's called Manawatu People's Radio, but it did have the name. It was Access Radio, wasn't it?
Yes, because Access Radio is part of a wider system. I think there are 12 Access stations over the country altogether, and they all have the same kind of mandate. They are by, for, and about the community. So it is community generated content that is made by the community and is directed towards their community of interest as well. So the government funds that in a way of getting alternative voices on the radio. So what we tend to host is people from quite different interest groups and people who want to speak programs in other languages and different religions and so on and so forth. So we get a really diverse kind of range of people on the radio compared to more mainstream stations who might have something quite different.
Okay, so how do they, they're all volunteers and they come to you or you try to?
They're all content creators, so they tend to come to us because they want to get their voices out there, and we have amazing platforms. It's not just radio. I mean, we obviously broadcast terrestrial on 999 AM, but we have live stream on our website and we're available via podcasts as well. We have a huge Facebook presence and a Twitter presence and an Instagram presence. So we're a real multimedia organisation and we can get the word out there in a myriad of ways.
Okay. So who's doing that? Is that the content creators are, you give a platform and they just use it?
Yeah, we give a platform, they record what they want to record and then it comes back to us and we disseminate it through all those different platforms that we have. And that's what our content team do, Hugh and Sam. They do an amazing job of that, getting information out there.
Okay, so you'd have, if these are just people from the community, someone in the community say, oh, I want to do a programme, what happened? Do they need training or?
Yep, well they come along to us and we have a chat about what they might want to do. All our services are at no cost at all, so people can come and do this for nothing as well. And then we give them some training and we get them recording basically. And our setup is pretty simple. It's a bit, we're sat in a studio right now, to the naked eye it probably looks quite intimidating, but it's actually a very simple system to use. And it's one you could even use at home, some of our recording things. And we just get people going with that and get their confidence up, and we offer ongoing training and supports and lots of opportunities to socialise with the other programme makers as well.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So now I know that I was involved in a programme several years ago and that was all done live in studio.
Yeah.
But now you do, a lot of people can record outside and just send in, or
they can.
Is much pre-recorded in the studio rather than outside?
Most people come into the studio and do it, but there are options to do other things as well. We still do a fair bit of live, but not so much at the moment because a lot of people are quite rightly a bit nervous about doing live first time because it can be a little bit of a recipe for disaster if you're feeling a little bit nervous about it. But we do have portable studios as well, and we go to Fielding every couple of weeks and we record from there to give people in rural settings a better chance to actually, you know, not have to travel into Palmerston North and be really Palmerston North centric. So we're working on that. We're working on getting little hubs out into different places just so that people, you know, not everybody's as geographically mobile. So just to increase people's opportunities to do that.
Yeah. Well, also timing for recording can be awkward as well. If you have to do something live, then you have to be available.
But if you need to pre-record, the studios are open from 9 o'clock till 6 every day, so there's a good space of time to do things as well.
Yeah. Are they heavily used then? You've got, what, one studio, two studios?
Yeah, there are bookings all the way through the day. There's generally someone in here at any particular time.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, right. And have you done much of that?
Yes, I host a couple of shows. I host a show called Fantastic Fielding, which is based around what goes on in the fielding community. And together with Nelson Lebo from the council, I do a show called Revisiting Resilience, which is about sustainability and resilience in the face of our current challenges of living with a pandemic. You know, because obviously that has raised huge questions about resilience and how we live our lives at the moment. We've all been forced to look a lot more locally in what we're doing, and Nelson is an expert on that. That is what he does for a living. He's the council's eco design advisor, so he is a wealth of information, and I love talking to him every week.
So what that does raise the issue of content. If someone has a weekly program, how do they make sure? Is this a problem for some programs? How to fit it? Are they all weekly or some?
Not all are weekly. There are options, really. You can do a weekly program or a program every couple of weeks. It suits you. I mean, we discuss with content creators about how they want to do this. Yeah. So we're really flexible. We just want people to come in and create something that resonates with them and with their community of interest. We just want people in here using the studios and getting information out.
Yeah. So do you find, are there issues in people managing to get the content if they made a commitment to a regular program?
There can be, but again, we're pretty flexible. And with the advent of Zoom, we've all learned that we can record from home and things like that as well. Yeah. So there's flexibility there. And again, we're really flexible because we know that people have lives. We like people to commit, but we know things go on as well. So it's fine.
Okay, now you mentioned Zoom, which that's something that really took off during the COVID-19 lockdown.
Yeah.
And so you could do the distance video recording.
Yeah.
The sound quality is not bad.
It's okay.
But technology's changed a lot, so it's much easier for individuals just to start recording now, whereas in the past you needed specialist equipment, would you say?
You don't so much need equipment. I mean, most computers these days that are any decent spec have a good microphone. And the system we use for recording on our computers is called Dark Audacity, and it's free to everybody. You can download it yourself, and you can
Dark
make a recording.
Audacity.
Dark
I just
Audacity.
Use plain Audacity.
I know, this is the brother, the darker brother. I think it has a couple more specs that are quite useful. Have a chat to Hugh about it, and he'll probably tell you a bit more about it. But that's the one that we prefer to use. But that's downloadable.
And that's another free download?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
So those things are all possible. And again, the sound's okay. It will never be as good as it is in our wonderful professional studios. Yeah. But, you know, certainly during lockdown, it was more than adequate.
Okay. Okay. You mentioned lockdown. Hmm. Was that very disruptive for...
It was disruptive for everybody, really, wasn't it? I think we were in a better position than most because people could record remotely. That was absolutely fine. Content kept coming in, and in fact, we got a lot more content because people were wanting to comment on behalf of their communities what was actually going on out there.
Okay.
And we also did a special live show that Fraser just came into the studio and did by himself every morning, where he was remotely interviewing different community organisations, you know, the really key ones, to see what was actually going on in the community right then. And that was a huge hit because that was just hyper-local information about what was literally going on that particular day, which was superb and had a lot of listens as well. But that's what NPR can do. We're so flexible and so locally based that we can give that information as it's happening pretty much in the community. So it was a tricky time, but it all worked out quite well for us. And like everyone and every organisation, some good learnings came out of it.
Yeah, and you're building up a record of programmes that have come in? You store a lot of these?
Gosh, yes. I believe they get archived. I know they get archived. I'm not 100% sure where, but they're all kept. They're all kept as well.
Some are they're online, available as podcasts for about 6 months.
I think it's actually changed now. I know on our website they're only on there for a week now. The whole set of rules have changed, but I don't know.
Download, it's only a week, but they're still there for access, I believe, for about 6 months.
Oh, cool. That's good to know. Yeah. And then they're kept afterwards.
Then you just
as well.
Store them somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. And I know, because this program in particular goes up on the Manawatu Heritage website, so it becomes part of the National Oral History Collection. So there's scope for other programs to do that as well, because there's quite a few that have that sort of history.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably worth promoting with the content creators as well. Mm.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So, we maybe if any are listening, we can tell.
That sounds good. Sounds good.
Okay. So how many staff are there in the station?
There are four at the moment. So we've got Fraser, who's the station manager, and who obviously oversees the majority of things. And we've got Sam and Hugh, who are the content team, and myself as the funding administrator and kind of spare projects person. So, yeah, it's a cool team of people. I get to work with three men, which is a very novel experience a lot of the time. I spend a lot of time freezing while they're boiling in the office and things like that. And I make a better cup of coffee than anyone. But it's all good, apart from that.
Okay. So, and have any interesting things happened to you in this process? Any stories about, you know, people's reaction to the radio station or difficulty getting funding? Or
funding's pretty easy because I've done it professionally for about 10 years, so I feel pretty confident in what I do. So that's always an honour to be able to fund things for a really cool organisation and project that's going on. And yeah, some of the key funding we got recently was for the Fielding Hub, which was a really big coup for us because we wanted to be able to get ourselves out there more. We needed that funding to help us be more mobile, and Manawatu District Council obliged through their creative communities. Another big coup for funding was our portable studios, which are a beautiful piece of kit. They are studio quality, but very compact and very easy to use, which means we can take them out to do different things, and it's going to enable us to do all kinds of cool things. My highlights are always meeting content creators because it's such an eclectic group of people that have come through this door. And the Christmas party every year is just like some massive cross-section of Palmerston North that comes in the door for 2 hours who would never normally meet or socialise and has a really good time despite their differences, because they're all brought together by the wish to have their voices heard via radio. So that is always a highlight for me. It's about the people that I work with, for sure.
Okay, so some people with a wish to have their voices heard. I was going to ask, is there a special character to people who do radio programs?
That's a really, really good question. People, I guess, who are generally really passionate about what they do and are just interested in other people hearing about what they do. People as well, I mean, it's interesting because I'm doing some, as you well know, I'm doing some interviews at the moment with different program makers and stakeholders about what they found. What they find good about working with NPR. And one of the constant comments is a sense of pride at being involved in something like this, and a sense that if you are on NPR for your field, you are viewed as some kind of expert as well. So I guess there's some credence there that goes with it. But mostly it's people who've just got a huge passion for what they do and they want to share it.
So if you don't know much about something but you want people to think you're really intelligent, do a radio program.
I guess technically, yes. But the case is we do have experts here in their fields. I mean, for example, we have someone like, you know, Greg Watson from Property Brokers, who's an amazing man, and what he knows about the rental scene and things about that. And he really wants to, you know, help people, especially in this current housing climate as well.
Yeah.
You know, for my interviews for Fantastic Fielding, we have people there who have, you know, worked for amazing organisations that just want to spread that word so that people can come and use their services to improve their well-being.
Yeah. So do you mention Property Bro, you get people doing commercial type?
No, work? Not in that sense. I mean, we don't advertise via NPR. So if someone comes on in a professional capacity, they're not really allowed to promote their business. Greg comes along as an expert in his field and he talks about property. He can mention what he does, and he does, because everyone knows what Greg Watson does, but his general conversation is about property and the property market and what's going on there. But technically you're not allowed to favour your own business. Those are the rules.
You do realise that all the banks in New Zealand have economic units where the economists aren't necessarily doing research. Their job is to have a media profile for the bank. So... yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, anyone can come along and talk. There are a couple of rules around it, but they're pretty flexible as well. But I guess the only big one we have is really around that self-promotion side of things. And, you know, obviously around some profanities and so on and so forth. Yeah. But this is a public forum. This is a space for a voice.
What about politics then? Is there a lot of coverage of that?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, we recently did candidates' interviews for the Palmerston North by-election. So Fraser, our station manager, he does have quite a political tilt, and that is quite interesting for him. And also that's important because my understanding is that those public forums started to disappear. So by us doing them, and we videoed them last time, it gives people the chance to actually hear those candidates speak, especially when you can't make it to some of the candidates' debates. So that kind of stuff is superb, and that was very well received this time around.
So you have video as well?
We're moving a lot more into video at the moment because people want to see things as well as listen to things, and especially for something like a candidate's debate, it's nice to actually see the person as well as, you know, actually hear what they have to say as well.
Now on the technical side then, is that you need an extra person there with the camera? You just need one camera, you use two, or you've got to keep moving around on the different people?
Depends what we're doing. I think we have a couple of cameras, and Hugh and Sam oversee that completely as the content creation team, and they do a very good job generally.
Mm. Yeah, so you've got someone organising the discussion and so on, and then someone else managing. Yeah, because you need an extra person.
Yeah,
in
those situations, it's traditionally been Fraser who manages the discussion, because that's something he's fantastic with. And Hugh and Sam in the background. I mean, you know, Hugh is a qualified sound engineer, and Sam's normally doing all the videography work as well. So it generally comes out sounding and looking pretty good.
Yeah, so it's not just a talking heads sort of structure. Is that that if you're just interviewing, you're sitting in the studio and you've got the camera, then it's, you know, the idea of talking heads, you just see a person talking and that's it? Or you think it's worthwhile doing that?
I think it is worthwhile doing that. I mean, certain situations, and we're just exploring how that looks at the moment as a new set of media for us. But we're increasingly using channels like YouTube as well. For example, the Indian show that we broadcast, that likes to be filmed, and that goes up onto YouTube as well.
Okay.
You know, just recognising that different demographics as well use different forums and prefer different forums, which is why we have that really broad media reach, because we want to reach as many people as possible. And we know, for example, that Facebook kind of has a demographic of 30 to 50-year-olds, whereas YouTube and Instagram have that much younger demographic, so we want to be hitting those as well.
Okay. So although this was under the umbrella Access Radio, it's not just radio, it's all the different
multimedia, multi-platform, and that's the way a lot of things are going now, just recognising you know, the recent changes that especially in the last 10 years have been huge in how we use technology.
Because at one stage everyone would just be listening live, wouldn't
they?
And so now, do you have any breakdown of how much is live listening and how much is using these other platforms?
I actually don't know. I think the majority of it isn't live these days, mostly because of people's timings, I think, and being able to commit to that specific time. We have a couple of morning shows, I believe, that are live, but not much else. But we do encourage it. You know, radio with a live audience is a different beast.
I don't mean necessarily the broadcast. Yeah. I mean people actually, when they're listening to the programmes.
You mean actual listeners? Yeah, people are listening, and we have data to tell us that people are listening as well. But again, it has been the advent of being able to download things and podcasts that have really got the listenership up as well, because people want to do things in their own time.
Yeah, and you could probably track those better than the live listening audience.
Very much so. We can track hits, that's for sure. So we know at the moment that around 200,000 people are listening to us a year from what we can gather.
And do you have some data on live listening?
Not off the top of my head. That would actually have to be a huge question, actually. He might know better than me. But I don't know. I mean, when people are made aware that something's happening at a time, they will tune in.
Is it something that you actually have to source? You have to ask people, the survey company or something, to identify? Or are there databases that you can tap? Would you know?
I mean,
If you're doing the fundraising, presumably you'll say, hey, there's these people who listen to what we do.
I generally just give numbers and demographics of people who listen to things. But I mean, things like Spotify will give you data. Things like Google will give you data as well. And that's basically all we can go on.
So that's the online access, basically.
We don't know how long people listen for. We know that they tune in. It's quite a complicated beast to get data from, to be totally honest, but
We
keep stats as best we can.
And do you find then, with given that there's a large proportion of the population to be relatively elderly, is there a technical barrier to them, do you think?
To them actually coming and recording?
Well, I suppose both listening and having access and recording.
Because we are terrestrial and we're on 9am, no problem at all. And actually, even though we're an AM station, and, you know, ideally it would be FM, but that's an issue. And that's a big discussion. But AM is actually more readily available in rural areas as well. So we know we're more accessible because we have that platform. So anyone can tune into radio. That's particularly easy. Yeah. As for content creators, I mean, we have people coming in here in their 80s doing recordings. Yeah, and, you know, occasionally they might need a little bit more help than other people. And that's fine. That's what we're here for.
Okay.
We make it as easy as possible. That's our job.
So are there ideas, you're broadening out into the video sort of things, you're extending the platforms. How do you see Manawatu People's Radio or Access Radio in general developing over the next 5 to 10 years?
definitely those multimedia platforms, and definitely pumping the fact that we are one of the remaining sources of independent media where people can come and create their own content. Now, if you think you go onto another radio station, you know, of course you can go on there and you will be interviewed.
Yeah.
But that is somebody else's agenda. When you come and make a program here, this is what you want to talk about, and this is the difference. This is the individual voices by, for, and about our community. And there isn't much of that about anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, with current changes that are going on in society, I think people are realising the power of that again, because our statistics during lockdown were certainly pretty great. People were tuning in to hyper-local information because they couldn't go anywhere. They wanted to know what was happening here. And these things are going to continue happening. Our world is changing, whether it's through a pandemic or through the very slow-moving, but now it seems to be largely ignored, problem that is climate change. The world is going to be a very different place in 10, 15, 20 years' time as well. So this kind of a forum, I think, is just going to increase in value.
Yeah, okay. Now we're also in a situation now where there's a lot of talk about the term fake news.
Mm.
So what about content? Is there any sort of assessment or overview of kind of you give?
Yep. So staff regularly listen to content, and when it's been, you know, kind of mixed and finalised, there's a listening that goes on there as well, just for quality control, really, and just to make sure what is going on is completely okay. And we also have listeners' feedback to us as well. If anyone hears something that they have an issue with, we will get feedback about that too. But, you know, programme makers know what the score is, and they know what they can and can't talk about, really. So
But the accuracy of content?
That's a very, very good question, because it's a set of personal opinions quite often. I guess the accuracy can't always be thoroughly checked. But
it is one of the issues for reporters. You know, how do you report something that's totally false? As long as you can say so and so said, then you're all right.
Yes,
you're covered.
Yes.
So even if it makes no sense whatsoever. So, and I should ask, given what you were saying earlier, you know, where people are being interviewed, then it controls the narrative and so on. I'm interviewing you here, so you're making it into an interview. I'd like a nice chat structure with Dan butting in as well. But it's turning into an interview. Am I controlling what you're saying? Are there things that you would rather be saying here or things you
actually, I think you've covered most things quite well. I mean there's always going to be that aspect of it if you come on a show, but I guess, you know, with NPR generally, the program makers and the content creators who come on and have guests, the guests generally have a pretty good idea what you're going to chat about with them. You've had that relationship beforehand as well. It's just a little bit different, I guess. There's just a different kind of freedom there, and I think the longer program times as well just means there's that chance for the conversation to flow as well that bit more. So, you know, people who come here, they can do half an hour slots or an hour slot if they want, which is a nice juicy bit of time to get into something. It really is.
Yeah.
And often things just develop quite organically. You know, you can come in with some questions, but you often find that the conversation flows in a different direction, and that's the beauty of it, I think.
Do you observe many programmes that are being recorded in the studio?
Yes, I mean, because we've got obviously the listeners can't see, we've got the windows in here, and we can hear what's going on as well. So it's quite a cool thing when the studios are full and there are lots of people in here to see what's going on.
How do you find, now one thing I found very early on in just doing recording, not even for broadcast, I found sometimes people, you just start recording and they're very conscious of the microphone and they're almost talking to the microphone.
Yeah.
In your observations, when a whole load of people just straight from the community come in here, they've never done this before, do you see that sort of reaction? Or the, because what I see here, I normally record in people's homes and so on, so it's a very relaxed atmosphere. And we've got these long arms with great big microphones and the microphone as big as my whole recorder. Does that atmosphere, you think, have some impact? Do you see people very conscious that they're on radio rather than just chatting?
I don't, actually. But I imagine some people do feel that way. When I've interviewed people in here, they start off a bit nervous, but then they forget about the microphone because they're generally chatting about something they really love. And once you get into that, those kind of things become peripheral. So I guess it could be a slightly intimidating environment, but we work hard to make sure it isn't, because a lot of things aren't recorded live, there isn't that pressure. So if people make a mistake, it's like, don't worry, we can just edit that out. Don't worry about it. You know, I just write down the time and, you know, we get it edited out. So it's absolutely fine. And people relax into it.
Do you do much editing then, or what would you
edit? Very little, usually. Sometimes people... I refer to it very professionally as having a brain fart, which sometimes I do as well. I'll get through an interview and some gabble will come out, or I'll just make a huge mistake and I just kind of go, oh, and just write down the time to have it edited out. But we all have those moments, where you go blank. But that is the view, the beauty of having good editing tools and working in a professional studio. You can sort that stuff out really easily.
Yeah, because sometimes some people, they think, cut out every and ah and so on, which just doesn't happen, because often just a conversation, the pauses and those sort of interjections often say as much as the discussion itself.
We cut very little out, only when it's requested or when it's, just, as I say, one of those wonderful brain fart situations.
Okay. So now you said you do two programs. You have two programs of your own.
Yep.
Did you get into those first or after you got?
I got into them when I started my actual salaried employment here at NPR, just because I was working with communities that I think needed a voice, and Fielding was one of them. And I work for Manchester House in Fielding, so that program is under their auspices, because Fielding has tons of amazing
things.
Manchester House is what? Manchester House is a social services organization, so it does tons of things. It oversees the largest senior hub in Fielding, and it has counselling, social work, emergency food support, budgeting services, and it runs a really successful methamphetamine support group as well. So it's kind of the Methodist Social Services equivalent of Fielding. So it's quite a big organisation. I'm their funding manager as well. So I do that under their auspices as a method of some outreach more than anything else, just involving more community organisations in what goes on there.
Any idea why it's called Manchester House?
I'm not sure originally. I do know the history, but I can't remember, because it's not on Manchester Street or anything like that. I can't remember. It is originally, and still is, it has quite strong church affiliations, so with the professionalisation of social services they become a little bit less, but it was started by four churches in the area, so I think that's part of the history. That's something you could probably find out, Stuart, the history of that, because it is quite fascinating.
Well, there was things like the Manchester block, but there's also a strange thing. We both came from overseas, and so did Dan. And I was surprised to see here adverts say, and now we've got a sale of Manchester.
It's like, really?
Because it's actually the sorts of products that must have originally come from Manchester,
the
sheets
and
things like that.
Yeah.
But, you certainly wouldn't call it Manchester in England.
No.
It's just...
No, I couldn't work that out to start with. I kind of got it. I knew what it meant, but I'd never heard it termed as Manchester anywhere else.
It's really funny. The evolution of language.
Very much so. But, that might be an interesting history for you to pick up on. The history of Manchester House itself is quite fascinating, because it's been active in the community for... since 1972, so it's got that interesting history going on.
Well, there is a very active body of local historians looking into a lot of these issues, and even writing sort of short books on some of these things. That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.